Welcome to Peace is a Choice, the podcast where we explore how conscious awareness can help us cultivate inner peace and transform our lives. I'm Natasha Wallace, and in each episode, we'll hear from guests about their personal journeys, the challenges they've faced, and how they found peace. Today, I'm joined by Ben Hewlett, partner at Grainger Reese, an executive search company that is a B Corp and increasingly driven by purpose in the world of natural resources, utilities, infrastructure, and the circular economy. In this episode, Ben's going to be sharing his personal journey, explaining his difficult relationship with alcohol and how he found peace in what was a challenging journey, sharing his advice for anyone who might be going through similar experiences. Lovely to have you here, Ben.
Nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, so why don't we kick things off by reminding ourselves of how we know each other, how we met and how we know each other.
So I think we met almost 10 years ago. I think at the time you were HR director of a consultancy called Hawley. Mm-hmm. And we met in Bristol, I believe. Yeah, I think it was all, coming up 10 years at least.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I can remember, I don't have a fantastic memory at the best of times, but I can remember thinking you were highly polished and highly professional. And,
changed somewhat.
Well, and of course, we had no clue that it would blossom into a long-term relationship. And here we are 10 years later, still in touch, and we've become friends, actually.
Absolutely.
And we were brought back into each other. We hadn't spoken for a while. I think we've stayed in touch for, over the years, haven't we? Every 6-12 months we get back in touch. But we were brought together again recently because we've now got a client in common.
We do, Reconomy. And I think probably for both of us, Reconomy as an organisation kind of represent that sort of purposeful nature of the work that we both like to do.
Absolutely. And they work in the circular economy space. I think you would be much better at explaining what that is than I am.
Thank you. So circular economy, in very simple terms, is the migration away from a linear economy. So in a linear economy, you have production of stuff and it goes through various cycles and processes in terms of whether it's bought, used, consumed, whatever, and then it's usually disposed of. And then at end of life, we then produce more stuff. Circular economy is about how we reduce the amount of waste that is sort of created in the first place. It focuses on how we reuse the assets that we create and how we sort of maintain and keep those things within the supply chain and sort of circular economy itself. And Reconomy are at the heart of doing that. So Reconomy sort of spend a lot of their focus is around how do we get products back into the life cycle? How do we make sure we reduce the amount of waste we're all producing? And how do we start to sort of perceive waste as an asset rather than something we throw away?
Yeah. So, hugely purposeful and very important work.
Absolutely.
And of course, we can talk a little bit more about purpose in a moment, but, I'm embedding conscious leadership into Reconomy. So they've chosen a sustainable approach to leadership to enhance the culture, I think, at Reconomy, and you find great talent for them.
Yeah, we've been really fortunate to have connected with Lindsay, and that came about through a chap called Neil Hayward. So Neil, I'd worked with previously, as had you, at High Speed 2. Neil is a huge advocate for the kind of work that you do and a real sense around why purpose and values and behaviours are really important to creating the right sort of culture. And Neil put me in touch with Lindsay and said, I think you'll get on famously. Unbeknown to me, you were also in touch with them and having conversations. And I think as often happens, and again, this sort of speaks to part of the journey, I guess, is when you focus on things that you really care about, when you focus on something that has real purpose, you tend to find that you come into touch with people that share those values and that purpose as well. So I think that it's interesting how things sort of have that rhythm.
Absolutely. And actually, if I think 10 years ago, we were babies.
We were.
We're now old, and I was going to say wise. I'll say old and grey. But, I would definitely say that I've become far more aligned to purpose over the last 10 years. And I think you have too. I think we've been on similar but different journeys, haven't we?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think as I've got older, I think, and this again speaks to the sort of the heart of why we're here today, I think I've given myself permission to focus on the things that I find or I have a passion for, that I find sort of that drive me. And I think whereas when you're younger, perhaps you're driven by other people's expectations, you're driven by other people's perception of what should be and how we should live our lives. So I think sometimes it takes some people longer than others, I guess.
Yeah. And sometimes it's hard to pivot. You know, it's actually hard to make the jump. I was fortunate enough to be able to set up my own business and my own leadership model. And, you know, I was able to forge that path. I mean, it wasn't necessarily easy to do the pivot, but I got there. And of course, through your role in Exec Search, you've been able to take the business in a very purposeful direction, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm very much part of a team. And again, when Grainger East first started in 2008, I think your motivations may be true. So we were very clear on wanting a business that was a great place to work, that clients would enjoy working with us and engaging with us, and we would work on purposeful work. The reality is in 2008, for lots of reasons, I think A, we were much younger. B, it was a very, very difficult time to come into the market given the economic crisis, that you end up focusing far more on performance. You focus far more on achievement and sort of commercial goals. And I think like my own life and like reflecting on yours, I think there's a moment where, or there were a number of moments through the last sort of 17, 18 years, where as a group, we said, why are we here? What is it that gets us up in the morning? It can't just be commercial gain. It can't just be working with great clients. It's got to be more than that. And I think we are now, after 17 years, in a place where I can honestly say Grainger East has that purpose. It has that drive. I think everybody shares in that kind of sense of it's bigger than all of us. It's bigger than just being a business that makes money for its shareholders.
How did you make the shift? Because I think that often we can, you know, we can recognize the value of purpose and even for, in terms of like the employee value proposition and what you're able to offer the talent who's part of the team. It's hugely compelling to have a clear purpose that is much, much bigger than profit. But how do you make that shift? I mean, is it something that you have to do over the course of time?
I think so. I think if you try and force something, you end up doing it surface only. Mm. I think that probably as a group, and the people that I work with, just as a point of reference, I've worked with the CEO, Richard, for 25 years. And I've worked with the other guys in the business for 20 plus years. So we've known each other an awfully long time. And so to your point earlier about being babies and growing up, I think there's that sort of sense if you grow up and then bit by bit, you start to look at each other and say, do you know what? We're now the grown-ups in the room. So rather than taking our lead from the clients that we worked with, rather than feeling like we needed to impress the sort of the adult, if you like, in the room, we were then the adult. And we said, well, hold on, why don't we do it on our terms? Yeah. So I think we had a number of iterative conversations and we got it wrong a few times. And I think over the last probably 5-6 years, we've started to get it right. And it's that sense of constantly reminding ourselves that authenticity, purpose, and values mean that you don't have to think about what you're pretending to be. You can just be, and you can sort of come to work with, and I know it's a very kind of maybe overly well-trodden sort of sentence, but, you know, come to work with your whole self, come to work authentically. And then when you're talking to clients, you're talking to candidates, that comes through, it resonates, there's a real energy and a real power to that. And I think once you start that and you build that momentum, then you can't go back.
It does require courage, doesn't it?
Definitely. Yeah. And I think, like with most things, and, you know, whether it's my own personal journey or whether it's Grainger East, I think there is a moment where you have to leap and you have to have that real sense of, and again, it's purpose. It's why am I doing this? And I think once you're really clear on that, and everyone's got their own individual thing. So I think if you were to speak to anybody at Grainger East, they would have their own individual motivations, both self, family, friends, whatever it may be. But at the heart of it, there's enough overlapping that you sort of, when you're all holding hands and you're about to take the leap, you say, yeah, this is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And whilst it's brave, I think it is also, it feels incredibly safe and it feels incredibly right and it feels good. It doesn't feel like you're leaping into the unknown. It feels like you're making an active choice and you kind of know it's going to be good, because actually what you're coming from, the push factor from where you were, is that it didn't feel right. It felt kind of, there was a friction there, that it felt as though this didn't quite fit. I often describe it to people, it's like wearing someone else's clothes. It doesn't feel quite right. And then suddenly you find yourself on the other side and you thought, this is going to be really scary. And it wasn't at all. It feels really good. Yeah. It feels very empowering. And your energy levels start to go up. And you think, if anything, why didn't we do it before?
And then do you meet your tribe?
That's a great question. I think yes. I think in a strange way, often the people that have been with you, it may be that there are some that no longer fit within your life. But I think the strange thing I found is that a lot of the people that were in my life previously are still there. And I think, if anything, you sort of go on that journey together. So it feels different, but actually there's a lot of the people that are the same. Having said that, going back to the point I made earlier about sort of getting back in touch with you and Reconomy and Neil Haywood, I do think that the more you focus on your purpose, the more you find others that resonates with, and you build new relationships, you build new connections, and that's really exciting. So I think your tribe kind of expands, is maybe how I describe it.
And then for anybody who's thinking, oh, that all sounds lovely, but I have no idea what my purpose is, how do you discover it in the first place?
Blimey, that's a big question. I think it's different for everybody. And I think ultimately, for me personally, it was an iterative thing of, for so many years, trying so many different masks, so many different ways of living, lots not particularly healthy. And then getting to a point in my life personally where it had worn away at me completely. So, and then when I started to really think about what did I really want from life and what got me excited, that's where my purpose was. It was it was this sort of warm sense. I mean, I'm quite visual in how I think about things. So I think about sort of shapes and colors. So when I thought about certain things like circularity as an example, or good mental health at work, or whatever it might be, those are the things that made me feel warm and fuzzy. That kind of made me think, yeah, this is what I'm about. This is what I want to do. So it was a little bit of happenstance, a little bit of fortune, and trying lots and lots of different paths that didn't work. Lots of failure, lots of making big mistakes. And being fortunate enough, I guess, along the way, that I had people to help pick me up, dust me off, and let me go again, and allowed me the chance to do that. So I think sometimes it's not a eureka moment.
Yeah.
It's not that kind of sense of you reach nirvana. I think it's literally can be by pure accident.
Yeah.
But once you get there, don't let go of it.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, Ben. Right. Well, I mean, you've been on an incredibly transformational journey personally. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened and what the turning point was for you?
Of course. So on September 22nd, 2023, I woke up after having a night out with colleagues that resulted in me blacking out, having drunk far too much. And in the next sort of 2 to 3 hours, I sort of bit by bit discovered that I had, drunk an incredible amount over a relatively short period, and had made some of my colleagues feel uncomfortable. And I was really fortunate that at that moment, one of my colleagues sent an email, and in that email sent it to me and copying in colleagues. And that note was really the first time somebody genuinely held a mirror up to me. So I think up until that point, lots of people around me would have said, yeah, he's definitely got a problem with alcohol. It's not a healthy relationship, but nobody had really confronted me. And I think people say to you that you hit your rock bottom, you find these sort of moments, and that moment of clarity. And I remember sitting in my lounge with my wife, looking at this email, and I had this strange sense of, on the one hand, a real sense of hopelessness and a real sense of being alone. But on the other hand, I had this sort of really bright light to one side of me. That was my colleague's email, was my wife being with me, was the response I had from other colleagues, which gave me this sense of I had a choice. And I think I look at that moment now, and I feel incredibly fortunate to have been given that choice, because not everybody who has challenges with drugs, with alcohol and other addictions, they don't necessarily have that inflection point. Sometimes they get to a point where they don't have any choice. And I was lucky enough to be given that agency. And that was where everything changed.
What do you think led you to be able to see that feedback as an opportunity rather than taking it as sort of criticism, or maybe getting caught up in feeling shame, etc.?
So I think there's probably two sides to it. I think the external factor was the way in which the email was written, and the fact that the person's focus was purely on my safety and my happiness. Yes, they were calling out the behavior, rightly so. But more importantly, they were interested in my happiness, my health, my safety. And they focused on saying, look, this isn't you. That's not you. I know you. And I think it was that real sense of pushing at my vulnerability around that, and someone being really caring enough to sort of point out the good stuff, not just saying, hey, you, that was bad, but actually, hey, you, that was bad, but that's not who you are. So I think that was the external factor. And I think the internal factor was that for 10 to 15 years prior to this, I'd been kind of in and out of therapy, worked with lots of different counselors. And so I'd kind of worked through a lot of the reasons as to why I wasn't necessarily happy, why I wasn't content with who I was, and probably why I drank. But I just conveniently ignored the fact that the drinking and that sort of addiction was a symptom of that. I kind of said, well, no, you know, that's just a part of my life. And this was the moment where I realized that was the last thing I needed to get rid of. That was my last sort of, and you and I talked recently about the big boss sort of theory around, you know, in life you have these kind of end of level bosses that you have to defeat. And probably alcohol was the one for me. I'd kind of like done everything else. Yeah. I collected all my stars. And yet alcohol was the one thing that kept on beating me over the head.
Yeah.
And this was, and this almost gave me that kind of the tool I needed to get rid of that. I knew it deep down, but it was the external factor that gave me that opportunity to say no, no more.
Yeah, okay. And then what did that feel like? Did you think, oh, wow, I have a chance now to change my life? Or did you think, oh, my goodness, how am I going to do this?
I think it was the former. I think I saw it as this opportunity. I am, you know, and again, I think we talked at the beginning about how this conversation could, I hope, help other people. But I think the things always reinforce is that everybody is different and everyone has their own way of dealing with things. And I think I am an incredibly stubborn person. I have a very strong sense of will and determination. And I think whereas in the past I'd burnt a lot of that energy on pretending to be other things for other people and being productive and being successful, I went, right, I'm going to turn this on, this journey. I'm going to turn it on making every second that I have from this point onwards a sort of positive step forward. So first of all, that's 1 day without drinking, 2 days without drinking, 3 days without drinking. And then alongside that, starting to reflect on the damage that I caused myself and others. And I don't know, it became very organic very quickly.
What did the drink, or, you know, the drugs, the numbing, I guess, what did it do for you? What role did it play in your life up until that point?
I think it probably changed over life. I think, again, once I, probably after about 3 to 6 months of being sober, I was able to start to look back and assess that kind of relationship. And I realized that I'd never had a good relationship with alcohol, ever. It wasn't like it sort of crept up on me. And I think, was I an alcoholic from the first time I had a drink? No, not necessarily. But I can honestly say it was never a good relationship, because what it did was it took somebody who was, say, 16, somebody really unsure of themselves, who had lots of anxiety about life, who didn't really know who they were. And it gave me this superpower to suddenly, you know, in my own mind, to feel confident, to be funny, to be kind of able to walk into a room, to be able to, when I was on my own, to be able to just put myself to sleep. You know, it had this amazing, it had all, you know, it's like super medicine, right? You drink it and you feel popular and you feel you're funny and it helps you sleep. I mean, it's, you know, it's a cure-all. And you don't realize that it's bit by bit by bit, just eating away at your soul. It's stopping you ever getting to know who you are. It's counter to all the things that you're trying to cover up. It's counter to that. And it was always there. And I think it just got more and more and bigger and bigger and bigger.
I have so many questions swirling around my head, but one of them, if you don't mind us going here, you and I have the ability to have wide-ranging existential conversations, which is part of the beauty of our relationship. And in one of our recent ones, you talked about doing therapy whilst you were on this journey of sort of healing. And I think, did you say it was art therapy?
No, art became a sort of part of it. So I think my therapist at the time realized that sometimes when it came to visualizing certain feelings, particularly when I was kind of really young, so probably at sort of 8 to 10, sort of real formative age, I found it really difficult to kind of put myself into that situation. But what I could do was put it down on paper in a drawing. So I would use pastels. And so we'd use that as part of the therapy. It kind of helped me illustrate how I was feeling and what that person looked like in my mind.
Yeah. And tell me a little bit about that. Tell me a little bit about the picture that was created.
So the one that really stands out, I think, was probably, it was initially it was a boy. It wasn't necessarily me. And I think it became me, was this sort of little boy, probably 8 years of age, sort of curled up in a sort of slight fetal position. And then around it was these sort of layers of lights and different colours that were, I guess, the way in which I then presented myself to the world. So inside was this sort of, remained this kind of like scared, slightly anxious, very unsure sort of core. But then I'd somehow been able to kind of create lots and lots of versions of myself that had been reflected out into the world. And because I'd been able to be reasonably successful, so I was able to get through school and, you know, to my sister's dismay, you know, without much revision and without much sort of, I always did okay. You know, I never was an A student by any means, but I was able to get through. And then into work, I kind of again had the gift of the gab, so I kind of got by. And so the reward for having all of these layers of protection and pretense kept on getting paid back. You know, it was like, it was almost the sort of the universe is kind of, you know, almost saying, yeah, it's working, keep going. But you don't realize just how much energy you're spending on creating that kind of force field, that projection. And I kept on coming back to that sort of core, that sort of that version of me in the middle, that kind of fetal position. And what we realized, or what I realized, probably more so actually post becoming sober, is I never ever kind of went into that person and kind of helped them. I kind of just, I saw them and I realized what the issues were, but I never went and said, it's okay, we're going to be okay, we're going to get out of this, or you know, whatever it might be. I never kind of dealt with it. And not until, again, I became sober. And then I started to bit by bit by bit forgive myself, bit by bit by bit, start to build up a sense of being able to say to myself, I'm a good person, I'm good at my job. I could never say those things. I could never, ever say I'm good at things. It made me cringe. And it all came back to that sense of that core, that little boy was never able to, I don't think he ever developed, really.
Where are you at with your relationship with that little boy now?
We have a good relationship. I think I've been able to say to that part of me and to him that, A, we're going to be okay, because I'm now there. That all of the things that, all the good stuff that that little boy was, manifested and became who I am today. So within that little boy was a lot of love, a lot of care, quite silly, good fun, quite funny. You know, there's lots of stuff in there that was kind of good stuff. And so now able to look at that little boy and see all the positives, as opposed to seeing it and feeling fearful or anxious or worried. And it used to be very black. It was a very dark image. And I think now it's far lighter. It's far more kind of, it's probably more a looking at a little boy rather than the kind of a slightly tortured kind of abstract form.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it actually just sounds like such a tremendous journey, and you've stepped into it with so much grace. And I think it's wonderful that, you know, you talk about the fact that I was able to forgive myself, because that's often such a difficult thing for us to do. We carry shame. How did you do that? How did you get to the point where you allowed yourself to be forgiven?
I think I realized that it was the only way that I was going to be able to move forward. So that email, that moment, it wasn't just an email. That represented probably, you know, all the residual sort of issues or damage I created with my family relationships, with colleagues, with friends. It represented all of that. And I realized that the only way I could move forward was to forgive myself. Now, whether those people and those relationships would forgive me or not, that's a whole different matter. And I think I've been fortunate enough that in the main, that has happened. I still think I've got a lot of work to do there. But I realized that was the key. The key was I had to forgive myself. And I had to learn to like myself and love myself. And without that, yeah, I couldn't move forward. It was literally a fundamental choice.
I mean, it really resonates with me, because that's exactly how I ended up finding my way through, was my little 8-year-old girl who'd been through, you know, some very difficult circumstances, who just didn't feel loved. I sort of had to go back to her and love her. And I think, you know, our child self talks about this on another podcast I've done recently, but our child self can carry a lot of responsibility for things that purely, you know, simply aren't our responsibility and aren't our fault. But also, you know, in order to be able to exude love and bring that to the world consistently, not through a mask, but pure love. I do think it starts with ourselves. You know, I think some people are just very loving people without a shadow of a doubt, and still have issues or trauma or difficult healing that they need to go through. But I definitely feel like I can turn up now as a much more authentic, loving, caring, understanding, compassionate version of myself, because I first did the work for me. And that sort of grounds you. It's a very grounding energy. It stabilizes you. And so now you're not so much in fight flight all the time, thinking, you know, worrying, what were they going to think? What are they going to think? Oh, God, what did I do there? Oh, God, that was embarrassing. Or, you know, I used to drink, you know, a decent amount. And then I became intolerant to alcohol. So I was sort of saved from myself. But I remember many, many mornings waking up thinking, oh, no. Like, what have I done this time? And I mean, this was an HR director. And I had a couple of people say to me during that time, like, you need, like, you're a role model. Like, you can't do that. You can't get that drunk and be that inappropriate. But I thought it was so fun and funny. And I thought being really un-PC and anti-establishment, being a bit of a rebel HR director, I didn't want to be a conventional HR director. It was sort of part of my persona to be a bit edgy and a bit naughty and a bit, you know, I liked that about myself. So, you do end up really looking at yourself and going, actually, who do I want to be? Why am I being like that? What is it that's driving that sort of behaviour? But I think it's only through stopping the numbing and having to really feel the feelings are you able to actually change anything.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. I think the other thing I'd like to mention is that it doesn't mean, even though I'm now in a much, much better place than I am, I have definitely found a greater level of peace. There's not really a week that goes by that I don't think about something that I could have done better, I could still improve. So I think it's a continual thing. And I think that definitely goes for, you know, relationships, that the relationships you want and that you value, because you realize that the residual damage of where you've been doesn't just go away just because I've forgiven myself, just because I've decided to make this decision. That doesn't mean that those around you and your past forgives you as well. You know, you've got to kind of keep working at that. So I would say also that it's not this sort of moment of transformation and you wake up and suddenly it's all, you know, hunky dory. You know, you've still got all those scars. You've still got to go through that process and still make difficult decisions and have difficult conversations. So I think it's really important to get the message across that it's not this sort of, as I said, reaching nirvana, you know, is anything but.
Yeah.
But what it does do is it gives you, well, it's given me the energy to be able to do that. Whereas before, I never had any energy. I was always running on empty. I was, to your point on the fight or flight thing, I was just always in survival mode. So I was either up or I was down. Now I have more energy, so I can have those difficult conversations.
Yeah.
I can go back and reflect on what I want and how I want to get there, and ultimately how the other person, you know, if it's a relationship or work scenario, whatever it may be, how you have that conversation, how you have a difficult conversation.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say that you sort of don't reach nirvana. It's an ongoing journey. Don't you feel that when you become more conscious, you then, it almost breaks down all that armor? So then it creates this huge amount of humility, but also the recognition that you're so imperfect and you're so flawed that you've got loads of work to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. I think, and that's kind of fun. It goes from being something that was your downfall. You know, I used to look at the things that I didn't like about myself and perhaps other people sort of said about me as this sort of thing that I couldn't solve, that was, it was taking away from me. So now I know, you know, I'm becoming increasingly aware of my kind of challenges and things that I need to work on. But rather than being scared of them, I'm kind of like, okay, that's something else to think about. That's something else to work on.
Yeah.
And that becomes part of the purpose. That, you know, rather than it being something to tick off, that's part of the purpose.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's sort of a curiosity and a willingness to learn and grow and evolve as a person becomes baked in.
Yeah.
I still think it's hard sometimes, though, don't you? I mean, I think that we're fragile as humans, and I still will have moments where I'll think, oh, God, please don't let that be a flaw. I don't want that to be part of who I am. You know, they call it shadow work in therapy and coaching, where you have to sort of look at the thing that's lurking around in the darkness, and you're like, oh no, that actually probably is part of me, and actually I probably do need to change it. And sometimes I will resist that. I'll, you know, the, you know, cognitive dissonance, I'll put some space between the reality and the truth. And I'll be like, it's fine, it's fine. You know, because not every day you feel strong, and not every day you feel confident, and not every day you feel able, and not every day you've got the ecosystem around you to support you. And especially if you're tired and stressed and burning out, you know, there's other things at play. I think it can be hard to confront. But, you know, as long as you're willing to revisit it, you don't have to fix it there and then. But as long as you know that it is a constant evolution, you know, you'll get there in the end.
Well, and I think that you bit by bit start to develop the tools to do that, you know. And I think it's worth highlighting that I'm, you know, it'll be 2 years in September, so it's still really early. So I've still got an awful lot to do. And I always remember sort of, you know, when you're growing up, you hear that kind of one day at a time thing. And I was like, that's, you know, what's all that about? But it absolutely is. You know, I've got an app on my phone called I Am Sober. And every day I click a button that says I pledge. And I can or can't, if I want to, put reasons why and that kind of thing. And at the end of the day, I click another button that says I stayed sober. And that for me means that even on days when I have doubts or have a bad day or whatever it might be, I've always got that. I've always achieved something. And I think the other thing that I've realized is that, and again, this isn't necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, it is just a fact, is I've become far more selfish because I have to be. Now, again, that comes at a cost because you don't have the energy to maybe do some of the things for other people that you used to. That's the other cost. There is a cost to it. But I choose that over where I was. I choose to be more selfish. I choose to focus on the things that I can control, and I focus on the people that I want to be with. And I've made the choice not, which is quite difficult in some cases, to spend my time with certain people or on certain things that would distract from that. So I think that's the other thing. There is a cost to it. It's not, again, it's not this sort of free decision you take, you know, having gone through a difficult period, having been an alcoholic, having had those challenges, that doesn't just go. So you have to make some difficult choices along the way. So it's, again, it's not all sunshine and rainbows, you know, it's hard work.
Yeah, it is hard work. And it's a commitment, isn't it? I mean, I've done some coaching sessions actually lately where the coachees that I've spoken to have sort of been feeling this sense of frustration and a lack of fulfillment. And in a few of those conversations, what we've gotten to is that they haven't been tracking, or they don't track, or they don't account for the progress that they're making on a day-to-day basis. You know, especially in the world of business, we have these big audacious goals that we're driving towards, or, you know, big targets. And until you've hit that, you know, everything else doesn't matter almost, because that's just the way, that's the nature of the beast. It's the way that we set ourselves up in the workplace. It's interesting you talking about how at the end of every day, you know, you've done that one thing and that gives you strength. And in neuroscience, we talk about, you know, the dopamine hit of progress. You get a much bigger dopamine hit from micro progress than you actually do from the big achievement of the goal at the end anyway. Like, they've proven that. So that's quite interesting. Yet very often, or rarely, do we look back and go, oh, wow, look at where I've come from. I mean, it's tremendous to see where you've come from in 2 years. I mean, it's only 2 years, and that you've stayed sober for 2 years. I mean, just think, that's a massive achievement. And every single day you've been on that journey. And I can imagine you've had hard days, difficult days.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely had difficult days. I think the first 3 months or so were probably the hardest. Mm. Although the motivation was the strongest. But I guess simply some of it's sort of physiological. It's some of it's just literally, you know, you're detoxing, you're getting rid of that kind of connection, that physical connection to the drink. And I think the rest of it has been, it's just literally one day at a time. And also the other part of it is, you mentioned there about within the coaching, that sense of, am I achieving, aren't I achieving, you know, that kind of sense of, what are we all striving for, more, or whatever. And I think the other thing I've done which has worked for me, and I've said it to a few people, is I've simplified my life. So whereas before I felt this need, and it's still there, the compulsion is still there, but I felt the need to try and be, to do everything, you know, to be on the board of Grain Juriste, to be on the exec, to be at different conferences, to be involved with the rugby club, to be involved with the cricket club, to be, just do everything. And I now don't. I'm now kind of, so my life is really, really simple. You know, I am still a shareholder at Grain Juriste, but I'm really focused on day to day. Just, I work with clients, I work with candidates, and I work with sort of other industry representatives in terms of that. And that's all. That's what I do. I focus on one thing and try and do it really, really well. And then I focus on my family, and then I focus on my friends, and then other things that give me energy, and, you know, things like cricket, for example, and other, those going for walks, wildlife. Those things that give me the energy to do those things. That's it. Keep it really simple. I don't really go out very much, but again, I'm really happy. I feel like I've been out enough in my life for a lifetime. And my life, I've just simplified my life. So again, there are sacrifices, but they're good sacrifices. You know,
and it goes back to the point about selfishness. I mean, you could argue that it's not selfish to do that. It's curating a life that enables you to thrive. And it sounds like you have been on a journey to figuring out what that looks like. And I, you know, I've been on a very, very similar journey. Rather than saying yes because you feel you have to, you say yes because you know it's going to benefit you, or it's going to allow you to be at your best and stay at your best. And then avoiding putting yourself into the situation where, you know, the old you might rear its ugly head, and trying to stay, you know, stay thriving. And I think a lot of people might see that as selfishness, but I think it's so, so critical to take care of yourself, because when you are at your best, then your family will get the best version of you. Your candidates will, your clients will, everybody will get the best version of Ben. And actually, surely there's huge upside to that.
Absolutely. And I think, again, I'd be really watchful of, you know, the word selfish, I think, for me, again, is often maligned and misunderstood. I think being focused on yourself, which I think is what selfishness is, it's not a bad thing. I think when it becomes at the cost of other people's feelings, or then it can become destructive. But I think it's in its pure form, you know, they often, you know, people, you hear people saying, you need to learn to love yourself first before you can love other people. You need to be able to be confident in yourself before you can advise or teach others. So I think it's that. That's the selfish bit I talk about. It's not suddenly becoming a horrible person, or I hope a horrible person. It's just simply saying, that's not for me. I can't do that.
Yeah.
You know? So if that makes me selfish, you know, in a negative or positive way, then that's, again, so be it.
And a lot of people would find this story hard to tell, Ben. I mean, it was interesting when we were sort of preparing for the podcast and I was talking to you about, you know, what are you prepared to talk about? And you were like, well, I'm prepared to talk about any of it. And, you know, and I think you even had a colleague of yours say, you know, what are you doing? Like, well, you're just going to tell the story. Because, of course, in our society, it's things like this are hidden. You know, we don't talk about them because they're difficult and they're, you know, exposing, I guess, in some respects. What's allowed you to find peace, I guess, or comfort in being able to talk about your story?
For me, it was a really necessary part of getting sober, staying sober, and finding out kind of who I was, and also finding out who around me I could trust and who around me I could build relationships with. So I sort of took, I don't know if it was a conscious or unconscious decision, but I took the decision to tell people about it. So when people ask me how I am, and how, if I haven't seen them for a couple of years, I tell them the story. And I did it this week with a client I hadn't seen for 2-3 years. And what I've realized it does, it gives me a sense of, I don't know, there's an honesty in it and a vulnerability in it. And I think, again, I'd spent so much of my life presenting a version of myself that wasn't authentic, wasn't true. I bullshitted, I lied. And I think, therefore, the power in talking about this, I take it back. I own it. You know, and when people talk about what was their influence on my getting to that point, again, I say, look, that's for you to reflect on. You know, I own this. And it is what it is. It's not, you know, not something to be ashamed of. It's not, it is just a part of life. And I think that's the thing, is we talk a lot about stigma. And I do often think that stigma is something, I'm not sure people do have, there is a stigma around as many things as people think. I think that social media, the media focuses on this, and then they may find somebody to talk about it. My experience is that whenever I've shared it, people aren't judging me. 99% of people have either said, that's amazing, well done, congratulations, really proud of you, thanks for telling me. Like, I've never had one person say to me, oh, shame on you, you know, or, oh, you're an alcoholic, I can't work with you anymore. It's just because I think most people, whether they've got an addiction or another challenge in their life, most people go, I've been vulnerable. And actually, there's a sense there that they go, oh, do you know what? That's quite nice, isn't it? We can all talk about how vulnerable we are. You know, we don't have to pretend we're superhuman. So that's, I've used it as a tool. I've used it to help me. You know, and every time I say it out loud, it makes me feel stronger. And I also think there's a bit that says to me, I spoke to Esme, who sits on our board, who's incredibly supportive of me doing this. And part of that with her and with our board and the business is that permission to be yourself. And look, do you know what? If someone then decides they don't want to work with you because of that, and do you know what? More power to them. Good luck to them. You know, that's up to them. That's not my choice. My choice is to be honest. My choice is to own where I've been. And that's it.
Yeah, I just think that is so important for people to recognize that it's unnecessary to shapeshift around others, to give them a version of you that you think they probably want. Because I would say, I don't know if there's any example that I can come up with from the hundreds of leaders I've worked with and coached, where the journey we've been on together has been about them being their more authentic self. Or allowing, giving themselves permission to be them and to be okay with that, where they haven't been a better version.
Yeah, I don't think anybody, and similar to you, I've been really lucky to work with some incredible people, incredible leaders, incredible businesses. And it's the same thing. I think, again, we growing up or coming into the workplace in the sort of mid to late 90s, having come through and grown up in the 80s, we created this really toxic sense of what achievement and success was. So we all kind of lent into it. You know, it was all about working as hard as you could. It was about, ideally, if you broke yourself at some point, that was a real badge of honor, that you worked hard, you played hard, and all this stuff. And I think most people that have come through that, therefore the generation of people who are probably now from, I don't know, say 60 down to say 40, are in some cases not reflecting on it. In others, I think more and more are. That wasn't good.
Yeah.
It's okay to sit there and go, that was just ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
And the more people that come out and say it's ridiculous, yeah. It's like that scene in Harry Potter, you know, when they're doing the thing with the thing in the wardrobe. And you kind of like taking your worst fear and you make it feel ridiculous. You kind of like, you say, that's what it's like. It's like you take this thing and you go, that's just stupid. Yeah. That doesn't make any sense. That's not something to be proud of. It's not something to be scared of. It's not something to be worried about.
Yeah.
Just laugh at it.
Yeah. So it feels as though like a very important sentiment coming from all of this is that it's okay to be you. It's okay to be your authentic self. That even if you're doing things that, you know, by conventional standards may not be seen as being good, that actually all you need to do is look at it and consider what you might want to do differently. And actually, even though you might think that everybody around you would shame you or have a negative view of that bad behavior, ultimately, you know, you do get support. People will back you.
Yep, I totally agree. I mean, and again, I think I said it earlier, everyone is different. And some people are not fortunate enough to have a safety net that catches them. Some people don't have as many avenues as perhaps I have, and I've been lucky enough to have. And I think if to those people, I would say that me and others perhaps like me who sort of share their stories, I would say that I'm, you know, if ever they come across me online or whatever, that reach out to me, because if there's one person you can reach out to them. You know, just you're never on your own, and it isn't as bad as you think it's going to be. Yeah. But as I said, you know, the reality is, unfortunately, there are plenty of people who do fall through the gaps. So I think that's the other thing here is that it's great to be able to talk about success stories. It's great to be able to talk about how I've got to where I am. But we've got to be really mindful that sometimes we need to actively go and help people as well, not just wait for them to make their decision, because some people don't have that agency.
And it feels like that email from your colleague was exactly that.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was one, I say to somebody, it was one of the most generous and love-filled things that you could ever do.
Yeah.
And I'll never, ever, as long as I live, forget what he did for me.
Wow.
Massive.
Wow. Incredible. Now, we could go on, but unfortunately, we're out of time. So I wanted to say thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. And where can people go if they'd like to find more out about who you are and what you do?
So, yeah, look, our website, grangerice.com. In terms of from a professional point of view, I'm on LinkedIn. So, again, search me up, Ben Hewlett at Grangerice. And, yeah, get in touch, have a chat, whether it's about work, whether it's about personal stuff. Always happy to connect and chat.
Thank you so much, Ben. I have a feeling this podcast is going to be incredibly helpful to many people. I really, really appreciate you sharing your story.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Honestly, it's been, yeah, I've really enjoyed it. I think I was quite nervous coming in, but I've thoroughly enjoyed it. So thank you.
Fantastic. Lovely.
Thank you for listening to Pieces of Choice. For any information on what we've covered in today's episode and to connect with my guests, head to the show notes. It would be great if you could rate and review the podcast and subscribe now so you don't miss out on any future episodes.